This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Health News Digest on the bigger picture. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health News Digest, the first of the year, in fact. I'm Tina Camilla, and joining me on the show where we bring the latest in health news is Lee Junyi.
Hi.
This time we are exploring whether to eat or not to eat. Junyi.
So the first story that we'll be looking at is about milk. And within milk, we have three stories. The first one is about fake baby milk in Johor. The second one is about a Belgian baby who died because of a vegetable milk diet. And the last one is a 55-year-old man who got MERS from drinking raw camel milk.
And speaking of drinking, protein shakes, they're all the rage, especially among the fitness community. But a woman was said to have died from protein powder consumption. Is there more than meets the eye with this popular supplement? We'll find out.
But before that, we'll talk about stevia, which is a natural sweetener. And Malaysia is Asia's fattest nation, so should we start looking at this zero-calorie stevia to replace sugar?
And to lead us into those stories, here's Sweetest Thing by U2, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest on BFM 89.9. I'm Tina Camilla, and in the studio with me is Lee Junyi. First story that we're going to cover today is stevia. So Malaysia is the fattest nation in Asia, as you have introduced to us earlier. And that's according to a very popularly cited journal article that was published in The Lancet. In 2015, the National Health and Morbidity Survey also supported this fact, revealing that nearly half of the Malaysian population above the age of 18 are overweight or obese. And it is often linked to a high sugar intake, among other things.
So should we start looking at sugar replacements? Stevia is a natural sweetener from a plant, and the plant itself is also called stevia. And it is a zero-calorie, zero-carb natural sweetener, and it doesn't raise blood sugar levels. Stevia is also 200 times sweeter than sugar. But if we're going to consider adopting it in the long term as our sugar replacement, should we first find out if there are any side effects on our health?
Sure. And the reason we picked this story is also because only recently, farmers in Sabah, they are expected to grow stevia for the first time this year. And this is following the works that have been done by the Malaysian Nuclear Agency that were able to produce a variety that's suitable for the Malaysian climate. So, Junyi, you spoke to Dr. T.E. Siong, the president of the Nutrition Society of Malaysia, on the research done on stevia, specifically on the side effects.
Yep. And so actually, there are no proven side effects. So let's hear what Dr. T has to say.
It is approved by many regulatory agencies in many countries. I have not come across any serious side effects that have been reported. There are a few cases reported, for example, infertility. But these are, for example, studies done on animals, on rats, and they are done at very high levels of intake. So at the normal intake of a person, normal beverages and foods, I do not foresee any serious side effects coming from stevia.
So since there's no side effects, according to Dr. T, I asked him if it is recommended that we can use it as a long-term sugar replacement, especially for normal people.
For weight management people, obese people, overweight people, certainly yes. It will be a help. For diabetic patients, it will be a help, especially for diabetic patients or older patients who want to control their sugar intake, calorie intake, and yet their appetite may be very poor. Diabetic patients do not adhere to their diet very well. So they need to still have good diet, good dietary intake. So they do not adhere to their diet, then with some amount of sweetness in their diet, it helps them to still eat a reasonable diet. So diabetic patients and weight management people, certainly yes. But for everyday people, normal persons, what I would encourage them to do is cut down sugar and also cut down on having a sweet tooth, having a liking for sweet food. That will overall be generally better. Nevertheless, sweeteners like stevia can play a role in helping them manage their calorie intake.
Do you have a sweet tooth?
I do, actually, I do.
And do you prefer stevia or you stick with sugar?
I still prefer sugar because stevia sometimes has a bitter aftertaste, especially some brands who use different parts of the plant.
Is that so? I've never tried. I'm not a fan of sweet stuff, so it doesn't bother me.
Oh, you're lucky.
Yeah, I like my coffee black. I think brown sugar is also said to be a better alternative to the regular white sugar. Honey and all the other alternatives, except those still have...
They still spike your blood sugar level.
That's right. And also, they are not zero calories. Stevia is zero calories.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Anyway, late last year, 13 policies on a healthy living environment were discussed by the Cabinet Committee for a Healthy Promoting Environment for implementation this year and next year, including imposing sugar tax. I don't know whether that means that stevia will also be taxed. Do you consider that sugar?
I think it won't be taxed because it's not sugar by its artificial sweetener. So in that sense, it's not sugar itself. It's not sugar that comes from sugar cane. So I don't think it'll be taxed.
That's a bit unfair, isn't it?
Yeah, but then again, stevia is like zero calorie and it doesn't raise your blood sugar levels. So I think why they want to impose sugar tax is because they want to get people to decrease their sugar intake, which, you know, causes diabetes and obesity and stuff like that. But stevia, on the other hand, won't cause that. So I think there's no need to impose a sugar tax on stevia.
Are you being paid by the stevia farmers from Sabah to say all these things?
No, I just want a sweet alternative to sugar.
But you're okay with dealing with the bitter side effect. Is that something that anyone's working on to reduce the bitterness?
I was reading that it depends on which part of the plant you take.
Okay.
So some parts has a bitter aftertaste and some parts don't.
Right. So we can't use the whole plant then. So anyway, speaking about the sugar tax, earlier this year, the Minister of Health, Dato' Sri Dr. S. Subramaniam, explained why sugar tax is not the ministry's top priority for the time being.
There should be an attempt to increase price of sugar by taxing it. But we never took it forward in any way. Sugar tax might not be... We don't consider it as the most important thing to be done now. There are many other things which have to be done are more important in controlling these diseases. Medically, we don't advise people to go and eat middle of the night. It's not something healthy. Reduce the number of people who are overeating at wrong time.
Your thoughts on implementing the sugar tax, do you think that that's a good idea?
I think it is a good idea in encouraging people to reduce their sugar intake. Because I think now we use a lot of sugar in our cooking and in a lot of our desserts and lots of our Malaysian food because it's cheap.
Yeah.
And it's very accessible. That's why we use a lot of it and we love it. So I think by implementing the sugar tax, I think it will actually help because vendors and restaurants would have to reduce the sugar they put in food because it will be expensive.
Are you sure that they're going to reduce the sugar in the drinks? Or are they just going to increase the price in line with the tax on the sugar?
Yeah, that can happen too, but it'll be a nightmare for all of us. So
and then when you ask for teh tarik ground manis, you're still going to be priced the same. You're still going to be charged the same.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so your soda drinks, everything that's sugary beverages in general, because part of the ingredient is sugar. So all of that, the cost would be transferred back to the consumer.
So everything sweet will just become more expensive.
Exactly. So this is what's happening in some countries that are imposing the sugar tax. The drinks are getting smaller and more expensive. So it's not that it's less sugary. The cost is just placed on the consumer.
I really hope that's not what's going to happen here.
All right. So let us know whether you agree with imposing a sugar tax or not. Or do we have the right to be fed on sugar? Tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a Twitter poll happening. Up next, fake milk and milk alternatives. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Camellia and in the studio with me is Lee Junyi. Earlier, we were talking about stevia as a possible alternative to sugar, the zero-calorie alternative that's said to not spike your blood sugar levels. That could be an option if we could deal with the bitter aftertaste. Apparently, that's something new that I found out about stevia. Now we're going to talk about milk. We have several stories under this banner of milk. First, we're going to talk about fake milk, and this happened last December. There were reports of fake baby formula in Johor. Tell me more about it, Junyi.
So authorities found counterfeit baby milk formula in supermarkets and pharmacies. So they found a total of 210 boxes of this fake baby formula in 5 supermarkets and pharmacies. And after that incident, they've had 16 more complaints of counterfeit baby milk formula. Some children fell sick after drinking the fake formula, and there was this case where a 10-month-old girl developed fever and red rashes, and her parents noticed irregularities in the packaging, so they reported it to the authorities. The difference you can see in the packaging is the genuine one, which is from a well-known brand of milk powder that a lot of Malaysians consume, is puffy, while the counterfeit packaging is tightly fitting to the powder. The counterfeit one has also sharp creases on both sides, while the genuine one doesn't.
This sounds very simple as you explain it, but I don't think we pay a lot of attention to packaging when we buy things. And you need to have a reference to the original ones to be able to make that sort of comparison, right?
Yeah, and I think your average daily consumer would just see it on the shelf. In a rush, I'll just take it and then I'll just buy it and bring it back home. And sometimes even when they're feeding their child, they haven't realized it. So I think it's quite a dangerous thing with this counterfeit baby milk formula.
Right. And it's quite surprising because, you know, supermarkets and pharmacies are carrying it. If it's sold online or on less legitimate platforms, you might not be as surprised. But yeah, 200-something boxes, that's a lot. And do you know how is it considered a counterfeit baby milk formula?
Basically, we don't know who, but then there's this group of people who produced this baby milk formula that imitated the original brand. It was not produced by the original brand, and we don't know where it came from. And actually, I'm quite curious as to how it got into the stores because,
exactly.
You know, you would think that the stores would have regular suppliers from the original brand. But yeah, that's what happened, basically.
Right. So we are wondering about the risks involved in purchasing and consuming counterfeit baby milk formula. And you spoke to Dr. Kent Wu, consultant allergist and immunologist, and he explained some of the risks involved.
The risk of consuming fake baby formula could be that it was contaminated, especially during the process of counterfeiting this product. It could be contaminated by bacteria or infectious pathogens. So one of the risks for consuming this fake baby formula is that the baby can become ill. They might develop diarrhea or gastroenteritis because in the process of counterfeiting this product, it was not done in a sterile fashion. Another possibility from consuming this fake baby formula is that there is inadequate nutrition. These formulas that were designed for infants have a specific nutritional guidelines, and these formulas are formulated specifically for the infant with extra nutrition, vitamins, and minerals. So when a person consumes fake baby formula, this formula might not have the necessary nutritional supplementation for appropriate health and growth. The final thing about this fake baby formula is sometimes it can be contaminated with other chemicals that can be dangerous. We all remember the melamine scare that occurred in China, which led to a lot of healthcare problems in children that were consuming this tainted formula. So this fake baby formula could also be tainted with other chemicals that can be dangerous for health. So these are the three things that I could identify from a person purchasing fake baby formula and not knowingly feeding it to their child.
All right, so when the authorities found out that these baby milk formula were sold in supermarkets and pharmacies, what did they do?
So they took the fake milk, they raided the stores, and whichever store that was reported to have this fake milk, they went to all the stores and took down the milk powder, and then they brought some of it to test by the Food Safety and Quality Laboratory under the Health Ministry and Chemistry Department. And what they found was the product was actually safe. But the only thing is that it doesn't meet the quality standards prescribed in the Food Regulations 1985 under the Food Act 1983 in terms of fat content.
What's the importance of fat content?
Well, Dr. Kent Wu will tell you.
The fact that there was not adequate fat shows that there will not be adequate caloric intake. So the growth will be affected. Now, if this was only a temporary event, I do not foresee any permanent consequences from this. Certainly, I think, and hopefully in the future, we can prevent this from happening.
All right. Do you think we can prevent this from happening?
I think it's hard to prevent it from happening because malicious people out there will always do what they do. So we just got to be extra vigilant, extra careful with what we give our children. I mean, I'm not a parent, but parents should be careful about what they give their children.
Sure. And of course, Dr. Kent Wu has the following advice for parents.
First of all, they should report and get the formula that they have to be properly tested, because the ones that were checked were the ones that they were reported and found in the market. Maybe there are some other formulas that are out there that hasn't been properly checked yet. So we're not sure if that has other adulteration or contamination. So if you suspect, please report that and have that properly checked. Secondly, I would recommend the parents who suspect that their child might have consumed a fake formula to bring their child to their pediatrician for proper evaluation to make sure that there was no long-term consequences that can be suffered from this problem.
Okay, so where can parents file their complaints?
They can either go to the National Consumer Complaint Center at ncccc.org.my, or they can go to the Ministry of Domestic Trade, Cooperatives and Consumerism at kpdnkk.gov.my.
All right, great. So moving on to the next story about milk, this time milk allergy. Apparently, last year, a seven-month-old baby from Belgium died because he was fed a diet of vegetable milk.
So his mother was unable to produce breast milk, and he supposedly refused infant formula when he was given it. So his parents thought that he was either lactose or gluten intolerant. Therefore, they decided to give him vegetable milk made from oats, buckwheat, rice, and quinoa. The baby, Lucas, died at 7 months from dehydration and malnourishment. That's because vegetable milk lacks the essential nutrients that babies need in their first year. The parents were also found guilty and were charged in court for causing the baby's death unintentionally. So we spoke to Dr. Ken Wu, and apparently babies are rarely lactose intolerant.
Lactose intolerance in an infant is actually very, very rare. And we, as mammals, produce lactose even in our breast milk, and it is one of the major nutrients found in breast milk. So a child being lactose intolerant is a very, very rare genetic condition. And these children are usually detected early because in the first few days of life, they really do not do well. They have failure to thrive. So I think this is a classic case of malinformation from these parents, and they decided to use a vegetarian formula. Now, vegetarian formula does not have the necessary nutrition, and it turns out that this probably was from a health food shop, and it was probably a self-made formula. And these self-made formulas were not designed for infants. They don't have the proper nutrition, the proper calories, and so the baby actually suffered from severe dehydration and malnourishment.
I think this is an extremely unfortunate and sad case that, you know, the parents thought he was either lactose or gluten intolerant and therefore fed him the wrong thing. I mean, they had good intentions. They were trying to take care of him. The report said that the mom would wake up at night a few times to try to feed him, but he was only 4-point-something kilograms at 7 months when he died. So I think it's a really unfortunate case.
I wonder why they did not speak to a pediatrician. If your baby is not growing at the rate that he's supposed to be growing, you would have alerted his doctor, and the doctor would be able to diagnose whether or not he's lactose intolerant and whether he needs an alternative.
Yeah, it beats me as well why the parents did not do that, but maybe they had a reason or they were not aware enough. Yeah.
Sure. Dr. Kent was saying that there are cases, very rare, but there are cases of babies who are lactose intolerant. So we find out from him, what are the alternatives available for them?
If a child has this rare genetic condition where there is a true lactose intolerance, we can use other appropriate formula. One of them could be soy-based formula, where the special nutritional guidelines have been formulated, and these formulas are lactose-free. And these are easily available over-the-counter and everywhere. And usually parents who are vegans, they prefer using soy formula. There's also another congenital condition called galactosemia, in which these children cannot take formulas containing lactose, so they are appropriate candidates for drinking soy formula. After having said that, there are also other specific formulas that are specially designed for lactose intolerant babies. But this will need a specialty consultation with a dietitian, nutritionist, as well as the pediatric specialist.
Yeah, there you go. They should have gone to the specialists.
They should have. So what Dr. Kent said just now about the rarity of lactose intolerance among babies brings about a question. So you know how a lot of us Asian adults, a lot of us are lactose intolerant. Why is it when we're babies, we don't have lactose intolerance, but then when we grow up, we become lactose intolerant?
The lactose intolerance in infancy is very, very rare. But it turns out that lactose intolerance in adulthood is not that rare. And this is because when we are born, there is a high production of the enzyme that breaks down lactose called lactase. This is found in the enzyme that's in our intestines. So in the infant, you have a lot of these enzymes. Now, as you age, the enzymes actually decrease. Now, this is a genetic factor. We know that Asians generally become lactose intolerant as they grow older, and a majority of Asian adults can become lactose intolerant. Now, this is very different from the congenital condition. That means there's a genetic where the child is immediately born without this lactase enzyme. So the one that is common is a form of a genetic hereditary and is usually found in Asians, whereas adults, the genes that is giving the instructions to produce this lactase enzyme in our intestine gets turned off over time. So in Asians, as we get older, we have less lactase and we don't tolerate the lactose too much.
Is there any way to prevent yourself from growing lactose intolerant?
Yes, that's a good question. Lactose intolerance in an adult is not actually life-threatening. It's uncomfortable. You get bloating, you get gas and abdominal cramps, sometimes diarrhea if you ingest a lot of lactose. But it's not life-threatening. So in this situation, the adult can find their dose, because intolerance doesn't mean that you cannot take lactose at all. It means that you may be able to drink a quarter cup of milk. But if you exceed that, if you take a half cup of milk, then you're going to get the problems. So there is each individual have their own dose. The second is that we found that if you consume a little bit of lactose every day rather than complete avoidance, you kind of stimulate your own production of the lactase enzyme. So if you have complete avoidance, you tend to be more sensitive than if you take a little bit here and there. It builds a little bit more tolerance. Now, there's also commercial products out there where you can take the lactase enzyme every time you're going to take food products containing lots of lactose. A common brand out there, which you can buy online or in the pharmacy, is called Lactaid. And it is produced in a chewable pill format. And you take that before you would take ice cream or before you would take a lot of cheese or before you take a lot of products containing lots of lactose. And that seems to help. The other final thing was that there are studies that show that taking probiotics also help improve your lactose intolerance. Now, what this probiotics does is it improves the gut composition of helpful bacteria. So this helpful bacteria will help you digest this lactose and not cause too much of the abdominal discomfort.
Are you lactose intolerant?
No, I'm okay, I think. But I also don't take a lot of dairy products. So I like cheese, but I also avoid that quite a bit. But I think we're the only animal to drink milk well into our adulthood. There are no other animals who do that. Didn't you find that very peculiar? For us to continue to drink milk, and not even our own milk, but milk of other animals.
Yeah, I think it's rather interesting. Maybe because we as humans, you know, we do research and stuff like that, and we're told that we need calcium from milk, you know, or we'll have like problems with our knees and joints next time, and that's why we drink milk into our adulthood.
Speaking of drinking milk, MERS, in December, a 55-year-old man came back from an Umrah trip in Saudi Arabia and was tested positive for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus from drinking raw camel milk.
Yep. So he went to his Umrah trip and he drank raw camel milk and he came into contact with camels in a camel farm during his visit as well. A day after he came back to Malaysia, he showed symptoms of fever, cough, fatigue and leg pain. So what he did was he went to the nearest clinic and he was treated for fever. It was only after 5 days that he went to the emergency department in the Klang Hospital to get treatment for it. But according to the World Health Organization, it is still uncertain as to what exactly causes the spread of MERS. But the World Health Organization also discourages touching camels, eating and drinking raw or not perfectly cooked camel products.
Health Minister Dato' Sri Dr. S. Subramaniam, in a statement to the press last month, advised the public, especially those going for Umrah, to avoid drinking fresh camel's milk to avoid contracting the disease.
Kalau boleh, jangan pergi ke ladang unta dan jangan minum susu atau makan daging unta di kawasan itu kerana daripada bukti sains, unta telah dikesan sebagai satu carrier untuk MERS COVID. Message ini walaupun telah dikeluarkan sebelum itu, masih ada mereka yang pergi ke tanah suci, mereka membuat lawatan dan minum susu fresh milk, iaitu tanpa dimasak, direct meningkatkan risiko untuk mendapat penyakit ini.
So I think the problem was that he drank raw camel milk. But according to the minister, it's okay if it's been processed, went through high temperature and handled correctly.
Sure. And for more on MERS, you can download the podcast Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, where we spoke to Dr. Wan Noraini Wan Muhammad Noor, the Ministry of Health's Head of Disease Surveillance Disease Control Division, who spoke about this disease at length, I think last year. Coming up next, protein powder. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest on The Bigger Picture. If you've just joined us today, we are talking about our food and how we should be avoiding certain things, I guess, including camel's milk and possibly sugar, if you don't want to be taxed for drinking sugary drinks. Right now, we're going to talk about protein powder and how an Australian bodybuilder died last year. Lee Junyi is in the studio with me to discuss this story.
So a 25-year-old Australian bodybuilder died last year because she was taking too much protein powder. But the thing is, she had a rare genetic disorder where her body is unable to digest protein. But a few publications reported on it, and these were their headlines. The CNN's headline was, Australian bodybuilder with rare disorder dies eating high-protein diet.
The West Australian headline, Megan Hefford's Protein Food Death Sparks Review of Sports Foods.
The Independent's headline was, Female bodybuilder dies from eating too much protein.
And I can't believe you're making me say this, but the Daily Mail headline, I'm quoting the Daily Mail. She didn't look sick. She looked beautiful. Protein shakes blamed in sudden death of ultra-fit mom age just 25 as her devastated family called for warnings on the popular diet supplements. Why are we quoting the Daily Mail?
Because some of the publications mentioned are tabloids. As you can see, their headlines were not exactly accurate, but it's a given that they would use eye-catching headlines to get clicks and readers. So the actual story was that the bodybuilder did not die from the fact that she took too much protein powder, but she died because she had a rare genetic disorder called urea cycle disorder, which causes a deficiency of one enzyme in the urea cycle, which stops the body from breaking down protein. So there's a lesson to be learned here, Tina. And what is it?
To read beyond the headlines and to not quote tabloids. I think CNN is the only one that carried a fairly accurate headline because it did say that she had a rare disorder and she died from a high-protein diet.
Yeah. But with that being said, taking too much protein is not good for the body either.
Really?
Yeah, we spoke to a dietitian, Mary Esau, and she told us how taking too much protein affects the body.
For a normal person, the body requirement is about 0.8 to 1 gram of protein per kilogram body weight. However, many people want to consume more, which I don't understand why. Because if you consume too much of protein, it can be burdensome to the kidney because due to excess of amino acids, and then it also releases too much of insulin, and then you become hyperinsulin, and it causes severe dehydration. It also tops up your calories because you're going to consume it with food and other things. It's just like, you know, you have a washing machine which is 8 kilos. You wash load of 8 kilos, but you decide, never mind, I'll put every 10, 12 kilos. After some time, the washing machine will say, hey, bye, I'm sorry, I can't take the load. It's the same story.
So yeah, protein is definitely something that our body needs, but taking too much of protein is not good for our body as well. So Mary gave us a recommendation on how to approach our protein intake.
So my recommendation is you should try to take your sources of protein from fish, egg, chicken, meat, dairy products and seafood. Because when you eat other proteins, they also have a lot of potassium. They have a lot of, say for example, if you take milk, it has got protein, it has got magnesium, it has got phosphorus, it's got calcium. So other nutrients are also involved along with the protein. So that is the benefit. If you can't consume this for some reason, then if you need to top up because you're doing an exercise or you are a vegan, then it should be a part of the protein requirement, not top up more than that. And you need to focus on all nutrients the body needs, just not the protein. I mean, this is the advice that I can give to the people who are thinking too much about protein powders.
And I think to reiterate that protein powder in itself is quite safe, although it's not regulated in Malaysia much because it's considered a supplement. Mary told us that they use protein powder in a hospital setting as well to give to patients like adults who are malnourished or people who somehow can't get enough protein in their diet.
Sure. And I think a lot of people are still going to continue consuming their protein shakes, especially those in the fitness industry, those who are gym goers. And then you have professional athletes who rely on that to meet their protein requirements. I don't think that this story is about if protein powders are lethal and fatal. I think you need to consume so much for it to really cause that kind of damage. This particular case that we are citing, the Australian bodybuilder, she has a very rare disorder that caused her to not be able to tolerate that high amount of protein in her diet, and eventually she succumbed to her condition. But I think for the rest of us, it's probably perfectly fine to have maybe that one or two protein shakes a day. Well, maybe not two, but one, I guess. We're average people.
Yeah.
but I know a lot of professional athletes who are, you know, doing two or three a day, including one before bed and so on. But
yeah,
I think they're doing it with their own self-regulated ways, I think.
Yeah, because Mary also mentioned it's important that you use the protein that you take. So she say athletes definitely need more than what's the normal recommendation. That's because they use the protein.
That's right. And we don't. So we don't need our protein shakes. We can have them from our chicken and fish and so on. All right. What's the take-home message here from all these stories that we've discussed today?
I guess with everything in moderation.
That's a very Mary Iso thing to say.
It is. Actually, I quoted her exactly.
Yeah. And she's been on the show for so many times as well. And that's usually always her take-home message, everything in moderation. I think you're right. Except for if you're a baby, then you don't want to be too, I guess, moderate as well, because they are probably on breast milk diet for like the first 6 months of their lives. So that's extreme for them.
Yeah, they can't take anything else. So I guess they have to go to the extreme for them.
Yeah.
But for the rest of us adults, everything in moderation.
You're an adolescent.
I'm an adult.
You're an adolescent, according to Dr. Sarah Sawyer, whom we've spoken to just last month about the age of adolescence. Her team published a paper that said that the age of adolescence should be changed from 10 to 19 to 10 to 24 because you guys just don't want to grow up.
Millennials.
Well, you can listen to that show. We have it on podcast. Just look up Age of Adolescence and you can see whether you agree with me or with Junie on this. That's all the time we have this week. We've been discussing whether to eat or not to eat. If you miss any part of this show, you can download the podcast on our BFM app available on Google Play or the Apple App Store. I'm Tina Camilla.
And I'm Lee Junie.
You've been listening to Health News Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.